somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakob Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Frit Ord, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 38, The Totalitarian Temptation, Part 1. In George Orwell's 1946 essay, The Prevention of Literature, he wrote,
"Organized lying is integral to totalitarianism, and would continue even if concentration camps and secret police forces had ceased to be necessary. A totalitarian state is in effect a theocracy, and its ruling caste, in order to keep its position, has to be thought of as infallible. Totalitarianism demands, in fact, the continuous alteration of the past, and in the long run probably demands a disbelief in the very existence of objective truth."
As we shall see, the Orwellian diagnosis of totalitarianism was surgical in its precision. But despite the defeat of European communism, fascism, and Nazism, the dark and bloody past of totalitarianism still casts long shadows on European liberal democracies. On the one hand, freedom of expression is a foundational value, ensuring the pluralism and autonomy that is anathema to totalitarianism. On the other hand, many countries restrict free speech to safeguard against totalitarian propaganda aimed at undermining democracy. This raises the question, should we be most afraid of totalitarian movements using free speech to abolish other freedoms and democracy, or of democracies abusing limits on free speech to silence dissent? In this first of a two-part episode on European totalitarianism, we will focus on the rise of Soviet communism and Italian fascism and the effects of these ideologies on free expression. Hopefully, this journey into the darkest of pasts will help shed light on how to grapple with one of democracy's eternal and inevitable dilemmas. What should be the limits of free speech? By the dawn of the 20th century, pre-publication censorship had been abolished just about everywhere in Europe, as we saw in previous episodes. The combination of liberal ideas gaining ground and the futility of keeping dangerous ideas away from literate and educated populations supplied by mechanized printing technology made old-school censorship impossible. But one huge exception remained in place. The autocratic Tsarist Russian Empire still clung to the bad old days. The supposedly modernizing Tsar Nicholas II ascended the throne in 1894, but still two-thirds of all newspapers submitted to the censors were denied publication. But after Russia's disastrous defeat to the Japanese in 1905, the Tsarist repression broke down under chaos and social revolution. Political parties from the left to the right demanded press freedom, and by October, printers in St. Petersburg simply stopped paying attention to the censors and printed what they wanted to, including fierce attacks on the government. For many Russian intellectuals, censorship was one of the main obstacles to modernization. As one paper declared,
"Only under freedom of the press can begin the peaceful evolutionary development of our exhausted fatherland."
Fearing the complete collapse of the regime, the Tsar finally gave in, and on November 24, 1905, Russia became the last European great power to abolish prior censorship of newspapers. As a result, journalism flourished and newspapers sprouted up. But Russia retained the most repressive environment for press freedom in Europe. Yes, preventive censorship was gone, but a whole battery of vague laws concerning sedition, slander, treason, and offenses against the church were eagerly enforced. Between 1905 and 1910, Russian courts shut down an astounding 1,270 newspapers and sent at least 23 editors to jail. The socialist press was singled out for especially harsh treatment. Out of the 416 issues of the Bolshevik paper Pravda, 126 were sanctioned. So were almost half the issues of the Menshevik paper Luch. Nonetheless, in 1913, there were almost 600 printing houses, more than 1,300 magazines, and close to 1,000 newspapers reflecting the various political and ideological movements that competed for the adherence of the Russian people. But in less than 6 years, almost all of these publications would be gone or nationalized. Censorship was only one component of the Tsarist arsenal of repression. In 1907, the Tsar unleashed his secret police, the notorious Okhrana, to arrest many of the leading figures of the socialist parties, including one Vladimir Ulyanov, known by his alias Lenin, a rising intellectual star of the Russian far left. Lenin had been internally exiled for sedition in 1897, but now he had to flee to Western Europe, where he would stay for the next decade, only to return with a vengeance. But even police state methods could not save the monarchy. In the chaos of the First World War, people once more took to the streets, and in the span of a few days in March 1917, the entire repressive machinery of the Tsarist state came tumbling down, and the Tsar with it. On March 15th, a revolutionary government came into power, composed of a mix of opposition politicians from moderate liberals to revolutionary socialists. In its very first public announcement, the provisional government declared freedom of speech, press, association, and assembly. And for a brief period, Russia enjoyed real press freedom. Though the honeymoon would soon be over, and the brutal measures of the Okhrana would pale in comparison with those of the new regime. The news of the revolution traveled quickly around Europe, and Lenin immediately traveled back to Russia, courtesy of a German government eager to dump an agent of chaos behind enemy lines. It's fair to say that the operation ultimately proved a little too successful, seen with German eyes. When Lenin arrived in Petrograd on April 3, 1917, the Tsarist system of censorship had entirely evaporated. As Lenin remarked, "Nowhere is there such freedom as exists in Russia today." But war and revolution is not fertile ground for liberty. In July, a wave of violent anti-war protests erupted throughout the country, and the provisional government felt extremely threatened. Not least by the Bolsheviks, who had been calling for violent revolution and were seen as the main instigators of the unrest and were thus fiercely denounced in many newspapers. On July 5th, the offices of Pravda were ransacked, all its workers arrested, and Lenin denounced as a German spy, forcing him into hiding. As we've seen, Karl Marx had actually been among the most vocal advocates of press freedom in the oppressive atmosphere of reactionary 19th century Europe. But Lenin was a different beast. He gladly took advantage of press freedom once censorship had collapsed. But the anti-Bolshevik newspaper campaigns seriously rubbed him the wrong way. And when the time is ripe, he promised to close down the bourgeois press by law since it served the capitalists and their defenders who were enemies of the people. These were ominous signs of things to come. Lenin was not only opposed to specific bourgeois newspapers. He was opposed to the very bourgeois conception of freedom of the press. To Lenin, economic inequality rigged the fundamental mechanisms of free speech in favor of the capitalist class. Freedom of the press was
freedom for the rich, systematically, unremittingly, daily, in millions of copies, to deceive, corrupt, and fool the exploited and oppressed mass of the people.
But Lenin had a ready solution to level the playing ground. He proposed to confiscate
all printing houses and the paper and distribute it fairly to serve the interests of the majority of people, particularly of the poor, especially of the majority of peasants.
Through the autumn of 1917, the provisional government was severely weakened by waves of protests and strikes, not to mention a conservative coup attempt, which was repulsed by Bolshevik worker militias. Feeling emboldened, the Bolsheviks finally launched their revolution on November 7th and took control of the Russian state, with Lenin and his Bolshevik party firmly in the driving seat, ready to usher in a new society based on the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Пока земля остается в частной собственности, государством всегда управляет небольшое меньшинство, взятое на 90% из капиталистов или из богатых.
The Bolsheviks immediately shut down a number of conservative newspapers in St. Petersburg, though they also included left-leaning ones. Then, Lenin signed the new regime's first legislative act, a decree on the press aimed against the counter-revolutionary press of different shades, and authorizing the suppression of publications deemed seditious, criminal, or calling for resistance. Anticipating a critical reaction, the decree further argued that everyone knows that the bourgeois press is one of the most powerful weapons of the bourgeoisie. In fact, the press was no less dangerous than bombs and machine guns. Accordingly, temporary extraordinary measures were needed to stem the torrent of filth and slander. From November 16th until the end of the month, around 5 newspapers a day were closed down in Petrograd alone. Several of the printing presses and property of shuttered newspapers were requisitioned for Bolshevik and leftist newspapers. But not to worry, these measures would all be terminated and the press granted complete freedom within the bounds of the most progressive legal regime once things had settled down. Needless to say, the moment of complete freedom never arrived, and the Bolshevik definition of progressive left much to be desired. In fact, things were set to get much, much worse. But those who believed press freedom to be a precondition for a new Russia did not give up without a fight. Writers, publishers, and printers protested loudly, and some continued publishing bootleg newspapers, and printers and publishers threatened with strikes. The liberal editor and politician Vladimir Nabokov, whose son was the famous author of Lolita, protested the contemptible and disgusting terror and crazy reprisal established by Lenin. But the fact that he went into exile is a good measure of how efficient his process were. Even former Bolshevists, like the world-renowned author Maxim Gorky, got cold feet and wrote critically of the Bolshevik excesses after 1917. And a week after Lenin's press decree, an intense debate on freedom of speech took place in the Central Executive Committee, the leading organ of Soviet power. On November 17th, the Bolshevik Yuri Larin tabled a motion to revoke the press decree, arguing that it could no longer be justified. But this measure was immediately opposed by another pro-Leninist Bolshevik, Varlam Avanesov, who argued that it would be
very naive to let slip from their hands such a powerful means of influencing the ideals of all workers, soldiers, and peasants.
In short, freedom of speech would have to be sacrificed until the utopian communist society was achieved where everyone would enjoy equal free speech. Avanesov's arguments promptly received the backing of both Lenin and Trotsky, who insisted that newspapers should express the will of the people, not of the banks. Boris Malkin, a leading member of the Bolshevik-allied Left Socialist Revolutionaries, attacked the double standards of Lenin and Trotsky.
We socialist revolutionaries were once prisoners of Tsarism, but we were never its slaves, and we don't want to establish slavery for anyone now.
Malkin favored the weapon of criticism, not criticism by weapons. Then it was time to vote. The motion to revoke the press decree was rejected by 31 nays to 22 yeas. The principle of freedom of speech had been formally killed by the new Soviet government and would not be revived until the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, however precariously. The socialist revolutionary Prussian sadly declared that the resolution
legalizes repression and clearly shows that the Bolshevik members of the Central Executive Committee are embarking upon a path of terror.
Prussian's prediction proved prophetic. On November 25th, the first free elections in Russian history were held, And to the dismay of Lenin, the socialist revolutionaries triumphed while the Bolsheviks received less than a quarter of the votes. So, in the interest of the people, Lenin quickly dissolved the Constituent Assembly. The first more or less free election would sadly also be the last until 1991. And now the Bolsheviks moved fast. First, they imposed a state monopoly on advertising in newspapers to sap the income of opposition papers. Violations were sanctioned with closure and confiscation of assets. On December 20th, a secret police force, the Cheka, was instituted to root out opposition and watching over the press. A month later, a decree empowered the government to sentence seditious journalists to jail, deportation, and banishment to Siberia. Sedition included any falsified and distorted news about social events since they provoked infringement of rights and freedoms of the working class. With such a vague formulation, in practice anyone critical of the regime could be quickly removed, and many were. But for the Bolshevik regime, a policy of subsequent censorship wasn't enough. To create the ideal communist society, Lenin insisted that we must create a press that will not entertain and fool the people with political sensation and trivialities. The first step was to close down the remaining independent newspapers. In March 1918, the entire bourgeois or non-socialist press was suppressed on account of its opposition to the recently signed peace treaty with Germany. And over the following year, all remaining independent newspapers, those that were socialist but not strictly Bolshevik, were shut down one after another by a special press tribunal. Around 200 newspapers in Petrograd and 150 in Moscow were snuffed out by judicial decree. The last nail in the coffin came in March 1919, when the paper of the Moscow Printing Trade Union was forced to close. A one-party press had finally prevailed, and not even the end of the bloody civil war in the early 1920s could persuade Lenin to end the temporary regime of censorship. But those who were subjected to censorship got off lightly. One did not have to express opinions that fell afoul of Bolshevik orthodoxy to be considered an enemy. In fact, belonging to the wrong social class was a much more serious crime. In 1918, a senior Cheka official explained,
"We are not waging war against individual persons. We are exterminating the bourgeoisie as a class. In this lies the significance and essence of the Red Terror."
The order to carry out systematic terror came right from the top. When so-called kulaks, a pejorative term used to describe wealthier peasants, rebelled against Bolshevik rule, Lenin sent an infamous telegram of August 11, 1918. In it, he ordered the public hanging of 100 so-called blood-sucking kulaks, as well as the confiscation of their grain. The terror may have culminated under Stalin, but it was commenced under Lenin. The destruction of opposition outlets and the silencing of dissent was one side of the coin of Bolshevik press policy. The other consisted of a massive spread of Bolshevik newspapers and propaganda, which, as we shall see, is an eerily common feature of both communism, fascism, and Nazism. Already by early 1918, the Bolsheviks distributed 884 newspapers and 753 magazines in 20 different languages, and the numbers just continued to soar. Gradually, membership of the Communist Party became obligatory for Soviet journalists to ensure the party control of all writing. But to Lenin, the new one-party press and wall-to-wall propaganda was the real definition of press freedom. As he asked rhetorically,
"Is there a country in the world in which the average worker enjoys anything approaching such liberty of using the largest printing plants and biggest stocks of paper to express his ideas and to defend his interests, as in Soviet Russia?"
Of course, by his ideas and interests, Lenin really meant his own, not those of individual workers whose only freedom consisted in agreeing with whatever talking points the party propaganda machine produced on any given day. And substitute Italian or German for worker, and Italy or Germany for Soviet Russia, and Lenin's ideal of press freedom is close to the fascist and Nazi ideals, which also consisted in a duty to advance the cause, through ideological uniformity. Having won the Civil War, Lenin set out to more systematically control the flow of information. Sure, independent newspapers had been closed down, but even with a one-party press and an oppressive state apparatus in place, Lenin was not going to repeat the mistake of the Tsarist regime. Had their censors not allowed the writings of Karl Marx? And for all the brutality of the Okhrana, the alphabet soup of revolutionary movements had been able to publish anti-Tsarist ideas, and even in internal exile, revolutionaries like Lenin had been able to meet like-minded people and disseminate sedition. The perfect Bolshevik state needed full control over the flow of information, even though they had already weeded out the publications of class enemies and ensured a monopoly for the healthy ideas of workers and peasants. So in 1922, a centralized censorship bureau known as the Glavlit was established to keep control over all publishing, including fiction and scientific research. Historian Herman Amolayev has painstakingly detailed the workings and practice of the Glavlit. It employed thousands of censors, almost all of them party members, across the country to weed out materials which constituted propaganda against the Soviet Union, divulged military secrets, stirred up public opinion through false information, aroused nationalistic or religious fanaticism, and or contained pornography. Glavlit censors went to libraries, bookstores, cinemas, clubs, and theaters and confiscated and destroyed thousands of books, movies, and audio records. In a standard move of all autocratic or totalitarian governments, whether religious or secular, a new annual index of forbidden material, the Perechen, was compiled to aid the destruction. The index contained references to forbidden authors and texts, as well as long lists of subjects and terms that could not be mentioned in print, including information about natural disasters, non-authorized statistics on homelessness and unemployment, information about foreign living standards, and of course, any mention of the Glavlit itself. A perfect illustration of Orwell's later point that, from the totalitarian point of view, history is something to be created rather than learned. To help Glavlit's constantly changing draft of Russian history, the bureaucrats worked closely with the secret police, giving it muscle to arrest and intimidate those who crossed the red lines. But with time, the systematic mistrust of the Soviet system caught up with Glavlit itself. Its list of prohibited material had to be approved further up the party chain of command, and a whole alphabet soup of agencies added new layers of censorship and control. On August 17, 1922, around the same time as the establishment of Glavlit, hundreds of famous intellectuals, artists, and academics were rounded up and deported from the country on account of anti-Soviet activities in an incident known as the Philosopher's Ship, since these intellectuals were deported by steamboats. The purge was meant first and foremost as a warning to ensure strict compliance to the Soviet line of thought. Stalin, who was now appointed Secretary General of the Party by Lenin, ominously remarked, "Let them remember that we carry out our promises and how we follow up our warnings." The huge amount of published material made it necessary for Glavlit to outsource most responsibility to editors and publishers and rely on self-censorship, backed up by the threat of harsh punishment. The so-called political editors employed at every publishing house were seen as the first line of defense against unorthodoxy. As the head of Glavlit, Sergei Ingulov, remarked in 1936,
"The greater the sense of responsibility of each editor, the less work there will be for the employee of the censorship, and I will not bear a large grudge if all the workers in this part of Glavlit are made unemployed."
A year later, Ingulov himself was made unemployed. He was arrested and shot in a purge. But in general, the censorship worked. An internal Glavlit report from 1928 concluded that
"the political and ideological orientation of the Soviet power is so clear, definite, and firm that harmful material is submitted only by people who either are inveterate foes of socialist construction or are lacking in political literacy."
The report noted with satisfaction that out of 300,000 inspected manuscripts from Petrograd and Moscow,
only 0.3 to 1% were rejected. The red lines of Lenin's great censorship machine had been internalized. The fate of Ingolov is a good example of the almost tragic comic scope of political terror in the Soviet Union under Stalin in the 1930s, when repression reached a literally genocidal level. Driven by Stalin's need to secure power in his own hands, his vision of violently reshaping Soviet society to fit his theoretical model, as well as his increasing paranoia, the tools of repression created by Lenin were sharpened further. A vast system of prison and labor camps, the gulags, which had already been used as a system of terror by Lenin, were vastly expanded by Stalin from 1929 and on through the following decades, holding millions of prisoners engaged in forced labor. In 1936 to 1938, the repression culminated in what has become known as the Great Purge, where somewhere around 1 million people were executed for political crimes. During the 1930s, Stalin's own paranoia was spread to the entire censorship system itself. The censors in Glavlit, understandably afraid what could happen to them if anything slipped through, became obsessed with removing anything that could possibly be understood as signs of counter-revolutionary activity, however far-fetched. Censors were instructed to pay close attention to so-called typographical errors, which could be perceived as a clever way of expressing dissent. This included such terrible things as hyphens in the words counter-revolutionary and anti-Bolshevik. As the instruction read, such a hyphenation of words constitutes the gravest political distortion. Images were also scrutinized carefully to control that they couldn't be interpreted in any but the official way. This led to absurdities such as this circular from the Central Moscow Bureau of Censorship from 1935, commenting on a party photo of Stalin and Dimitrov.
The curls on Comrade Dimitrov's forehead interweave in such a way that they create the impression of a drawn swastika. Glavlit categorically forbids further printing of this picture.
But not even the most hyperzealous censors were safe. In December 1937, a chief of a provincial censorship bureau sounded the alarm to his superiors. He had noticed disturbing signs in a portrait of Stalin. On the sleeve, an image of Mussolini can clearly be made out. On the chest, one can distinctly see the letters that form the word Hitler. Regrettably, his superiors thought otherwise. The poor censor was immediately removed from his position, and his later fate is unclear. By the end of the 1930s, and on the eve of World War II, Stalin's combination of paranoia and ruthlessness radicalized the already formidable censorship apparatus built by Lenin. He now presided over a highly efficient juggernaut of repression, ring-fenced by a Kafkaesque layer of various officers that not only controlled all publications, but also each other, and was manned by an army of bureaucrats whose orders could be enforced by secret police and sanctioned with oblivion in concentration camps or a bullet in the back of the head. The workings of this machine was entirely unhampered by even the semblance of any due process or individual freedoms. So in 1940, the chief of Glavlit could boast that in 1939 it had controlled more than 7,000 newspapers, 41,000 books, all the materials of the press agency TASS, some 1,500 broadcasting stations, 23 million postal packages with foreign literature, 4,700 printing shops, and 70,000 libraries from which Glavlit removed political harmful literature. This literary vandalism was carried out by more than 6,000 employees, around 200 executives, and 4,300 censors, in addition to administrative staff. In 1939, this army of repression had carried out 16,126 deletions to material after editors had already improved material for printing. And from 1938 to 1939, Glavlit issued 199 orders to destroy almost 8,000 politically harmful books of some 1,900 authors. Altogether, more than 16,000 titles and more than 24 million copies of printed works were removed from libraries and the book trade network. To these organized crimes against literature should be added sometimes hundreds of deleted lines in each of those works that actually survived. Although the blatant absurdity of the Stalinist regime does have a certain comic quality, it was, of course, no laughing matter. Stalin's legacy ranks among the worst crimes against humanity in modern times. Under Stalin, more than 1 million people were directly executed, perhaps 18 million were sent into forced labor camps, and millions died from famines that were sometimes used as a weapon against so-called class enemies. In fact, much like Nazi Germany, Lenin and Stalin's state-sponsored propaganda was instrumental in facilitating mass murder of specific groups of people. As historian Timothy Snyder shows, Stalinist propaganda depicted the kulaks, already labeled class enemies, to be eliminated, as pigs with the connotation that they could be slaughtered. Soviet censorship and propaganda was also internalized outside the USSR. In the Provincial Literature, Orwell wrote that previously one had to defend free speech against conservatives, Catholics, and fascists, but that now
there can be no question about the poisonous effects of the Russian mythos on English intellectual life. Because of it, known facts are suppressed and distorted to such an extent as to make it doubtful whether a true history of our times can ever be written.
But Russia itself still has not fully exercised the legacy of Stalinism or the spirit of Glavnit. And perhaps fittingly, the latter helps protect the former. In 2017, the British film The Death of Stalin came out, which ridicules the Stalinist system and its aftermath. But the Russian Ministry of Culture banned its distribution in Russian theaters. After assuring the public that we have freedom of speech, the ministry added a but. The film desecrates our historical symbols and was an act of extremism. Still, 1.5 million copies were downloaded illegally, and a number of cinemas overlooked the ban and ran the film. That would not have been tolerated under Stalin.
E il privilegio di ospitare nel vostro mare le forze navali dell'Italia fascista.
While communism locked the Soviet Union in an ideological iron grip, another totalitarian ideology would rear its ugly head in Italy and contribute to the further erosion of liberal democracy and free speech in Europe. Benito Mussolini is credited with coining the term totalitario to describe fascist Italy based on the foundational principle of all within the state, none outside the state, none against the state. But before Mussolini and his fascists came into power, the Italian press enjoyed a moderate degree of freedom. There was no pre-publication censorship, but the censors had pretty extensive authority to suppress newspapers, books, films, and theater performances if they crossed red lines such as defamation, offending religion, morality, the king, parliament, or government. Although this was not markedly different from many other liberal European states at the time. Benito Mussolini should have appreciated freedom of the press more than most Italians. Before becoming the poster boy of European fascism, he was journalist and editor of the socialist newspaper Avanti. But he left the Socialist Party because of its neutralist stance on the war. Instead, he established the pro-war nationalist newspaper Il Popolo d'Italia, or The People of Italy, which, ironically, he used to push for censorship. Italian fascists first revealed their deep intolerance toward political opponents in 1919, 3 years before they held any political power. Fascists broke into the office of Mussolini's old newspaper Avanti to trash and burn down the place before marching back to the offices of Il Popolo d'Italia with loot from the now incinerated competitor. This incident was an early warning of the fascists' utter contempt for political difference. Much like the German Nazis, the fascists thrived on a combination of post-war demoralization and Red Scare from following the chaotic events in Russia, which threatened to spread to the rest of Europe. In the fall of 1921, they organized themselves into a political party known as the Partito Nazionale Fascista. 1 year later, they had 250,000 members. "Our program is simple," Mussolini declared to the Fascist Congress in Naples in October 1922. "We want to rule Italy." After a surge of fascist violence and a dramatic march on Rome, the established parties panicked and invited the fascists into government and made Mussolini prime minister in the vain hope that they could make him play by the rules. But fascism views democracy and its rules, procedures, and emphasis on compromise and persuasion as a recipe for defeat and as a sign of weakness and degeneracy. When Mussolini presented his new administration on November 16th, he threatened the members of parliament with fascist revolutionaries if they didn't give him special legislative powers. In December 1922, Mussolini warned his opponents of what he had in store in an unsigned editorial in his newspaper Il Popolo d'Italia.
"Looking at the daily show of irresponsibility by certain papers, nobody will be surprised if the fascist government will impose censorship or will adopt even more severe measures."
Once firmly in the driving seat, Mussolini unleashed his intolerance. One way to silence his opponents was with bare-fisted violence and intimidation. Gangs of black-shirted thugs terrorized anyone whose ideas fell afoul of fascist doctrine, which turned out to be a long list, including socialists, republicans and union workers, actors, newspaper editors and bookshop owners. In late 1922, fascist gangs killed 11 communists in Turin and forced others into hiding. The fascist veto not only silenced those directly affected by threats and violence, the authorities started internalizing the black lines as well. In April 1923, black shirts terrorized a number of bookshops in Rome until the authorities gave in and pulled a book by a dissident fascist. The most infamous case of intimidation took place in the election campaign of 1924, when the fascists kidnapped and murdered the outspoken socialist Giacomo Matteotti in cold blood. But legal means were also part of the fascist arsenal against free speech. By the end of 1922, Mussolini instructed the prefectural censors to investigate so-called subversives and arrest leaders of the Communist Party, like Antonio Gramsci, the famous Marxist philosopher. But the murder of Matteotti evolved into the biggest crisis of Mussolini's government, and the fascists were bombarded left and right by critical papers. Mussolini had to muscle the press if he wanted to survive. 1 month after the assassination of Matteotti, a decree allowed the prefectural censors to suppress critical newspapers without prior warning. Mussolini completed his transformation into Il Duce and installed a full-scale fascist regime in 1925. Or, as he was cheeky enough to call it, an organized, centralized, and authoritative democracy. Once in office, he argued for the need for more surveillance and tougher action against enemies of the state. After four attempts on his life, he won public support for these drastic measures. The assassination attempts were the fascist version of the German Reichstag fire, providing Mussolini a pretext to ban opposition parties, enforce strict censorship and surveillance, and launch a fierce propaganda campaign. The police were unleashed to search and close print shops run by socialists, communists, and republicans. Then in November 1926, Il Duce strangled the last remnants of press freedom with a draconian law on public security. No less than five articles were devoted to muzzle the press. The police could seize everything,
contrary to the political, social and economic framework that constituted a state, or damaging to the prestige of the state or its authorities, or offensive to the national sentiment, to moral sense and public decency.
This included banning the promotion of birth control and abortion. Augustus would have been proud of Italy's new emperor. So obsessed with controlling the press was Mussolini that he instructed his press office to obtain his personal authorization before banning or ceasing publications. Despite this onslaught on free speech, Mussolini gave a speech to the chief editors of all Italian newspapers in October 28th, in which he absurdly declared that the press enjoys more freedom in Italy than in any other country in the world. This conclusion depended on Mussolini's view of free speech, where journalists were compared to musicians in an orchestra, and the diversity of each instrument is counterbalanced by the desire to play the same tune. A fitting metaphor that Hitler would enthusiastically endorse once in power, and also reminiscent of Lenin's claim that workers in Russia enjoyed the highest degree of freedom anywhere. Which was all true if freedom consisted in agreeing with totalitarian political ideologies. As we have seen in many previous episodes, laws do not necessarily reflect practical reality. For the first decade of fascist rule, book censors weren't as busy as you'd think. Until they stepped up their game in 1934, they were actually more busy in liberal states like Britain and America. US authorities confiscated copies of James Joyce's Ulysses, while prominent fascists requested an Italian translation of Joyce's work. And D.H. Lawrence's novel, Lady Chatterley's Lover, could be had in its original English version in Italy without any problems in 1928, while the British censors nixed the same novel until the 1960s. This, of course, is not to say that there was more free speech in Italy than in Britain or the US. Obviously, the surveillance, intimidation and violence, as well as the closure of newspapers and the strict laws banning political speech, meant that many Italians self-censored. But Italian censorship was still a far cry from the all-seeing eyes of Glavlit in Russia. The situation changed in 1934 when the fascist censorship machine got a complete overhaul. The excuse was a novel about interracial love titled Sambadu, Black Love. The cover showed an African man in a European suit holding a white woman in his arms. Il Duce was mortally offended. He thought Africans racially inferior to Italians and was planning an invasion of Ethiopia. Accordingly, the interracial couple was unacceptable in a nation which wants to create an empire in Africa. If Mussolini had taken the time to read Sambadu, he would probably have been less offended. The forbidden romance ends when the white woman realizes that Sambadu is lazy, indolent, distrustful, and often a liar, and that the blood of her child will be polluted by his African genes. Seems like bona fide racism to me. But Mussolini still ordered the prefectural censors to promptly seize all copies of the novel, which was offensive to racial dignity. On the following day, Il Duce personally signed a circular which instructed publishers to submit 3 copies of every new book before publication. One for the local prefecture, one for the General Directorate of Public Security, and one for the press office. For all intent and purposes, Mussolini had reintroduced pre-publication censorship. In theory, the publishers were still free to distribute their books without a prior vetting, but in practice, most waited for the thumbs up or censored themselves to avoid financial losses if a book was pulled. The de facto censorship regime sent shockwaves through the Italian publishing world as the prefectural censors dramatically intensified their control. Only 3 books were suppressed in the first 3 months of 1934. But in the 17 months following the Sambadu incident, a staggering 260 books were banned. An additional 74 books were only allowed with cuts and modifications. Most of the prohibited books were offensive to public morality. Others were too political, even if they weren't directly anti-fascist. The overhaul of the censorship machine was completed in October 1935, when the new Ministry for the Press and Propaganda got direct authority to ban or order the seizure of any harmful publication. Again, these are hardly Glavlit-style stats, but Mussolini's fascist censorship machine was beginning to show its totalitarian teeth. And in 1938, they started to bite. The regime created a so-called list of unwelcome authors. It mostly included Jewish, anti-fascist, and so-called decadent writers. In the same year, the regime ordered a ban on the circulation of all foreign books whose content is incompatible either politically or morally with the principles of fascism. Central to Mussolini's rise and hypnotizing effect on many Italians was his carefully crafted image based on sophisticated propaganda, which in many ways was more important to cementing the totalitarian ideals of fascism than censorship. Journalists had an important role to play as long as they abandoned traditional values such as scrutiny of power, impartiality, objectivity, and a commitment to furthering the truth. In the words of Mussolini,
"Fascism requires militant journalism. Newspapers must strive to find an essential uniformity, to serve the cause and to ignore the rest, burying it in the darkness of absolute indifference."
Mussolini already began to develop his propaganda machine in 1923, when he expanded the responsibilities of the press office from passive monitoring of the press to active promotion of the regime. The first priority of the office was the rational restructuring of the pro-fascist and national press. Accordingly, newspapers must be an instrument of propaganda supporting Italianness and the regime. In 1924, the propaganda effort was strengthened by putting the press office in charge of radio broadcasting and movie productions. Initially, the Nazis, and not least Goebbels, admired Mussolini. But as we shall see, Nazi propaganda and control of the public sphere was highly methodical and systematic, so Nazi and fascist propaganda cross-fertilized. In May 1933, Goebbels was invited to Italy so he could tell about his new Ministry for Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda and visit Mussolini's press office. In an internal report, the Italian head of press office expressed the need to step up the game to keep up with the Nazi propaganda machine. In August 1933, Mussolini promoted his son-in-law and planned successor, Galeazzo Ciano, to chief of the press office. And 2 years later, the office evolved into a full-fledged ministry for the press and propaganda. The ultimate goal was to have complete control of all mass media. The 6 directorates of the new ministry covered propaganda, national and foreign press, radio, film, theater, and music. And the number of employees grew from a meager half dozen in the early 1920s to a whopping 800 in 1937. But for all the legal and violent intimidation of Mussolini's fascist state, there was a reason why Goebbels was invited to Rome. For while fascism first found fertile soil in Italy, it was in Germany that fascist ideology, oppression and propaganda would be perfected with disastrous consequences for free speech and democracy. And when free speech and democracy had been eliminated, there would be disastrous consequences for just about everyone else. Even with a centralized system of censorship, the fascists never forgot the violence and intimidation. When they came into power, the black-shirted thugs were simply replaced with officers from the National Police or Carabinieri. Between 1931 and 1938, the Carabinieri made almost 600,000 arrests and 33 million police reports, as well as carrying out screening of mail and correspondence. Sometimes it was enough to give the Italians the feeling of being followed everywhere. In a matter of days after coming into power, the fascists set up a growing system of surveillance. The regime established a secret police known as the Ovra in 1927. Think of it as an Italian version of the Gestapo or Cheka. By the end of 1927, there existed files on 100,000 individuals. According to the director of the Division for General and Special Affairs,
"The records allow us to examine, at any time, the total number of subversives sorted by their political affiliation and geographical location."
The system was running on a tightly managed network of spies and informants who willingly informed their neighbors and colleagues. With a system like this, everyone became his own censor, as you never knew who was listening in on your conversations. But the regime didn't only turn to the stick. It had many ways to encourage collaboration from writers, artists, and intellectuals, including financial awards and loans to those who were willing to abandon academic, journalistic, and artistic freedom and become a well-paid mouthpiece for fascism. Not all writers and intellectuals were for sale or easily intimidated.
One of the most outspoken anti-fascist writers was the Turin publisher, editor, and radical liberal Piero Gobetti, who used his sharp pen to fight Mussolini until the bitter end. When the fascists came into power, Gobetti devoted two special issues of his liberal paper, the Rivoluzione Liberale, to the dangers of Mussolini's fascism. He called Mussolini a primitive head of a band of savages possessed by a dogmatic terror. Mussolini reacted furiously. He personally instructed the prefect of Turin to arrest Gobetti for conspiring with subversive communists. A month later, Gobetti established an anti-fascist publishing house and invited leading anti-fascist writers on board. Mussolini twice had Gobetti arrested and interrogated. The fascists finally broke Gobetti in 1925 when they closed his publishing house and Rivoluzione Liberale. But what ultimately silenced Gobetti was the favorite tactics of fascists, violence. He died at the tender age of 25 after a savage beating by fascist thugs. It's interesting to note that where modern Russia has limited free expression to prevent the denigration of Stalinism, Italy has limited free speech in order to prevent the glorification of fascism. In 2017, the lower house of the Italian parliament passed a law widening the ban against fascist symbols and propaganda. But to better answer the question of whether democracies should fight totalitarianism with censorship and repression, we must turn to perhaps the most notorious democratic collapse and totalitarian takeover in history. The fall of Germany's short-lived Weimar Republic and the rise of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. That's next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Lars-Emil Nissen and Matthias Meyer provided essential research. If you like what you heard, please leave a review on iTunes and share on social media.